This is 5 o'clock shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network, originating at WBAI. In today's program, we will be looking at the retrieval of the concept of May Day in the context of the Occupy protest. We'll be speaking with Staunton Lind about that. Also, a development for anti-death penalty advocates in the state of Connecticut. We'll be speaking with Laura Moy of Amnesty International about that. And there's a secret deal being worked out in Afghanistan. We'll speak with Robert Naiman of Just Foreign Policy about the perpetual stay of United States troops there. All that and more on today's 5 o'clock shadow. Stay tuned. I'm Robert Knight in New York. This is 5 o'clock shadow. I'm Robert Knight in New York. And the concept of May Day, which began as an international labor celebration, has been diluted in these United States. And May Day is the rallying cry and call for putting the focus back on the 99%, the workers and people otherwise distressed by the economy and the usury and deception that's involved in the operations of Wall Street and major financial institutions. We're going to speak about the history and future of May Day with Staunton Lind in just a moment. But on our way to the studios today, we stopped by the Wall Street occupation at the federal building across the street from the stock exchange, where a dozen people were gathered with signs, and they spoke about many things, including the odd concept of people being put inside metallic police cages and that being declared a free speech zone, which means that the rest of the world is not. Here's what it sounded like at Wall Street just a short time ago. The sounds of the Wall Street occupation earlier today. This is 5 o'clock shadow. I'm Robert Knight in New York, and in anticipation of the so-called day without the 99% on the 1st of May 2012, we are now joined live by Staunton Lind, who has been studying the concept and meaning of May Day. Welcome, Staunton, to 5 o'clock shadow.
Good afternoon. Something certainly seemed to be going on with excitement.
Yes, indeed, and more to come on May Day. And my first question to you is, how did America get it wrong and put it in September?
Well, of course, what happened was that rank-and-file workers in the United States called for a nationwide demonstration on May 1st, 1886, to demand the 8-hour day. They weren't asking for anarchism or socialism, much less communism, which didn't yet exist. They wanted the 8-hour day. And 2 days later, there was a deadly riot outside the McCormick Works in southwest Chicago, where agricultural machinery was being made, and workers were killed, and that gave rise to this so-called Haymarket demonstration the next evening, May 4th, when a bomb was thrown, and more persons died, and in the end, 4 men who had nothing to do with the throwing of the bomb were executed. So that was where May Day came from, and it was picked up by socialists in Europe and became an international workers' holiday. And only after World War I, when the international communist movement came into existence, did communist nations and communist parties begin to sponsor May Day. I, for example, when I was 6 years old, was part of a gigantic May Day demonstration in New York City and was carried on the shoulders of a man who volunteered for the Abraham Lincoln Brigade and was later killed in Spain. So you had this tradition. And after World War II, in the period of the Cold War, the United States government was unhappy with May Day. And so they made May Day, or tried to make May Day, into Law Day, when bar associations would give solemn speeches on the meaning of legality, and to make the workers' May Day into our Labor Day, which has become a kind of ritual for end of summer and starting school again, speeches by politicians, a beer and bratwurst in the backyard, anything but politics. So that I think part of what is going on this year, very courageously begun by Hispanic workers and organizations in 2006, is the recovery of May Day for the whole American working class. It doesn't belong to the United States government. It belongs to the memory of the Haymarket martyrs and the idea of solidarity.
This is 5 o'clock shadow. We're speaking with Staunton Lind, one of our great historians. He has the foreword in the re-release of Howard Zinn's On History, and he is also the author of The Fight Against Shutdowns, Youngstown's Steel Mill Closings, as well as Solidarity Unionism at Starbucks. And Staunton, you mentioned the 8-hour day, and yet it's my understanding that in Europe there are very generous vacations, that in many parts of the world there are siestas during the work day. And here at the heart of empire and capital and technology, there has been a tremendous labor savings through automation, whether it be computers or machines. And yet, we're still talking about an 8-hour day. At this day and age, what's wrong with the labor movement?
Well, you're raising a very big subject. Let me first just reinforce the premise that there are other countries, and I'm thinking especially of Mexico, where the Haymarket martyrs are remembered much more vividly on May the 1st than is true here in the United States. The men who died, Albert Parsons, August Spies in particular, the Mexicans have translated their last remarks into Spanish, and those are read aloud in the Zócalo, the central public square of Mexico City. So there's been a kind of migration of the radicalism of May Day, the essential radicalism, from the United States to elsewhere in the world. Now, I think what you're asking is, what's left in the United States, or how do we pick up the pieces and begin to imagine the kind of labor movement that Albert Parsons and the others had in mind? And that is a very big topic, but let me just say in one of those one or two sentence manifestos that people on the left exchange with each other, that I think the key to everything is the right to strike. Because the CIO was founded on the proposition that a union would bargain collectively, give away the right to strike for the duration of the collective bargaining agreement, and hopefully receive in exchange grievance arbitration and various material benefits. I think it was a disastrous error. In fact, the interesting fact is that the man who drafted the Wagner Act, the National Labor Relations Act for Senator Wagner, the act that passed in 1935, created the National Labor Relations Board and all the rest of it, that man said that he and Senator Wagner had deliberately put into Section 13 of the original Wagner Act, saying nothing in this statute is to be understood or interpreted to diminish or take away the right to strike, because they foresaw correctly that what was going to happen was that people would say, well, trade unionists, now you are recognized, you have the right to bargain collect, you don't need the right to strike any longer. And in the most emphatic terms, the people who created the Wagner Act said, no, that's not what we have in mind, because when working people give up the right to strike, when, where, for what reason, how they desire, they've given up everything. They no longer have power.
In the spirit of disclosure, here at WBAI, under AFTRA and now SAG-AFTRA, our contract has a no-strike clause, and it seems to be prevalent across the country. So
oh,
many
it's
unions.
Universal. It's universal. I don't know of any major collective bargaining contract that doesn't contain such a clause. And in fact, the very first CIO collective bargaining agreements, when the auto workers and then the steel workers in the spring of 1937 entered into collective bargaining agreements, they contained the no-strike clause. I think this was a concept that John L. Lewis and later on Ruther and Murray and the others favored, because truthfully, these folks were a little frightened about their own rank and file going on strike whenever they wished. I had a friend, the late Marty Glaberman, who lived in Detroit and was very close to the League of Revolutionary Black Workers, and he said that in Detroit, in those days, when that movement was at its height, there used to be a saying that an optimist was a person who brought his lunch to work. A realist knew they'd be out on the bricks before noon.
Stoughtonland, I wish our union were the Wobblies. Because,
well,
The IWW is the only one I could find that advocates having a strike clause.
Well, I think that's right. But remember that contracts don't go on forever. And maybe you need to say to your bargainers, look, for this particular contract, nothing is more important to us than getting rid of that. Forget the 5% increase on the night shift. Get us back the right to strike.
Staudenland, you have certainly explained so much of labor with such great panache and finesse. And I'd like to conclude by asking you about the relationship between labor on this concept of May Day and what you see both old and new in the Occupy coalition.
Well, I'm very much involved in Occupy Youngstown. We are putting on a play based on Clifford Odette's 1935 play, Waiting for Lefty. Our play is called Waiting for Lefty in Youngstown. We don't have many taxi cab drivers in Youngstown who were the rank and file of Odette's play, but we do have some very similar issues. I think that everywhere, Occupy groups who are primarily made up of college graduates with heavy student loans who can't find decent jobs are reaching out to African Americans, Hispanics, and trade unionists. And that's taking very different forms in different places. And of course, on the West Coast, there were some dramatic efforts along those lines during the winter months. And I think that, we have to kind of be tolerant with ourselves and realize that this is a complex undertaking. You have a pretty bureaucratic endeavor in the trade union movement and a hopelessly anarchistic endeavor in the Occupy groups, and they're trying to find common ground. And I think we should wish them well and hope that this May Day will at least represent the desire for a coming together on both sides of that divide, which I'm sure will have many defeats, many successes, take different forms in different places, but is so very important. All over the world, it's students and workers acting together who have made revolutions.
How can people follow your work, sir?
Well, I suppose my books are listed somewhere. I'm working on a book just now that should come out in the fall, and it's on Archbishop Oscar Romero's concept of accompaniment, as opposed to the rather, I argue, two-dimensional organizing, which I think has been characteristic not only of the trade union movement in this country, but Saul Alinsky's community organizing, and more than we might care to admit, the activism of the 1960s.
We're speaking with Staudenland, the great historian. And what final word would you have for us to keep pushing for financial, labor, and social equity?
Well, I think we might want to remember not only the general strike for the 8-hour day, but Albert Parsons, who was a leading radical in Chicago at that time, who escaped to Wisconsin. I believe he was living in Milwaukee, disguised himself, cut a mustache or grew a mustache, probably could have saved his life, took a train back to Chicago, and walked into the courtroom to join his colleagues at the defendant's table. I think that was an act of courage and solidarity that is way out in front of what any of us have achieved too. But is a good action to remember on May the 1st.
Well, thank you so much for joining us live today, Staunton Lynn, the great historian. This is 5 o'clock Shadow.
My pleasure.
All right. I'm Robert Knight in New York, and we are now joined by Laura Moy of Amnesty International. And another great historic struggle or issue has been the question of the death penalty and the execution of it, and whether or not it is cruel and inhuman punishment as defined under the United States Constitution. In any case, there has been a significant advance on that issue in the state of Connecticut. And Laura, welcome to 5 o'clock Shadow.
Thanks for having me.
There is, for proponents of life, tremendously good news coming from Connecticut. Why don't you tell us about it?
Sure. Well, last Wednesday, we were just elated to hear the news that Governor Malloy in Connecticut signed a bill that the legislature passed that would repeal the state's death penalty. So Connecticut joined the ranks of 16 other states and became the 17th state in the United States to do away with the death penalty. That's 5 states that have done this in the last 5 years. And to us, a really important signal of the progress we're making towards abolition of the death penalty across the United States.
It being such an emotionally charged issue, and with law and order advocates being full tilt in favor of it, can you tell us how this impulse was pushed forward in Connecticut? How did the anti-death penalty people win?
Well, no success like this for human rights typically comes overnight, and there was a very important community of people and movement that was built up over the last 10 years or so. And they were able to really connect with people across the spectrum, including people who are formerly involved with law enforcement and the judicial process, who have come to realize that the death penalty really is an empty symbol, an empty promise. And about 200 murder victim family members also came on board with this campaign, saying, you know, we have suffered the most of anybody. We, more than anybody, knows what it means to lose a loved one to murder. Yet we have found the death penalty to not be useful to us or healing to us in the process of coming to terms with our deep loss. And we think our state will be better off for justice and human rights. And you will actually find more closure when you get rid of the death penalty and you start looking at some of these more constructive alternatives.
There are also issues about wrongful executions, and in any case, the descriptions that we see are that it is tantamount to torture, medieval with modern needles. I've heard so many reports, Laura, that the so-called cocktail actually is laced with tranquilizers because of the burning sensation of the lethal drug in the mix. Can you speak a bit about the barbarity of execution, no matter how it's done?
I think this point is difficult for a lot of people in the United States to understand because people get so fixated on some of the most egregious crimes that occur. But when we're talking about human rights, we're talking about what is the standard that our society ought to hold up as the highest standard that represents the best that we have to offer as a civilized and humane society. And the death penalty in the United States has been sanitized on the surface to make people feel more comfortable with what is actually a very cold-blooded killing. There's usually 3 steps in the process of having an execution carried out, although some states are moving to a one-drug protocol. But the idea is that you paralyze the prisoner, and then you eventually stop their lungs and their heart. And because of this paralyzing process, we really have no way of knowing what a prisoner is feeling in the process. But even if you put that to the side and you think about the prospect of having somebody sitting in prison for many, many years, knowing that at one point they will be led to a chamber where they will be strapped and held defenseless while people are administering poisons to have them be killed. I mean, there are very few murders that I think are as grisly as that, and yet we are lifting that up as a symbol of justice when it's completely unnecessary in addition to being inhuman.
Laura Moy is with Amnesty International, the death penalty desk. And in the United States, there was a moratorium that was declared by the Supreme Court in, I think, 1976, and then the resumption of it in latter years. Can you give us a census, as it were, as to what states continue to practice or attempt to practice the death penalty?
Yes, and actually this is the 40th anniversary year of that Supreme Court decision that got rid of the death penalty, at least for 4 years, the Furman versus Georgia decision. And today we see the death penalty globally as well as in the United States is really being carried out by a small number of states and countries. Within the United States, most of the 33 states that have the death penalty on the books are not executing people with a lot of frequency. It's become more of a regional phenomenon. The majority of executions, in fact, about 80% of executions are being carried out in the South, all the states that used to have lynching and slavery. Texas accounts for about a third of all the executions that happen in the country. But even in those states where the death penalty has some deep roots, we're seeing signs of progress. Even in states like Texas, the number of death sentences and executions are on a downward trend. So it's very interesting when you look across the country to see that not only are states like Connecticut considering bills that get rid of the penalty, but the practice overall is really waning because people are really coming to understand what this thing is about. They're coming to understand the inaccuracy and the unfairness that riddles the system and the terrible rate of exonerees to executions or exonerations to executions that we're seeing as more and more people are proving that the system really is not getting it right.
Well, you highlight a very important point there, that there is an inevitable undercurrent of race and economics in regard to the death penalty. And then again, on the public level, there's some degree of international xenophobia when the president goes bragging about someone he deprived of life extrajudicially, in the case of Osama bin Laden, for instance. Can you help us understand a bit how discriminatory the practice of the death penalty is in the United States?
Well, the death penalty is no different than the rest of the criminal justice system, which is very biased against those without the means and people of color. When you look at the issue of race in the death penalty, you not only see these historical connections to lynching and slavery and the oppression of other communities of color, but you also see the way that life is valued in the criminal justice system. When a white person is murdered, the person who is being tried for that crime is usually where you see the death penalty being sought. You see racial bias at various stages really throughout the death penalty system, and that's really not that surprising given how deeply race impacts the overall criminal justice system. And with regards to economics, you know, the overwhelming majority of people on death row had a court-appointed attorney because they could not afford their own defense. You rarely find people of means who have committed homicides tried in capital cases where the death penalty is being sought against them. And, you know, you have very wonderful public defense lawyers out there who do heroic work, but even when you have lawyers who are competent and not drunk and some of these other horror stories, they are almost invariably under-resourced. They often don't have the resources they need to conduct a proper investigation and to really bring the best case to the jury so they can really sort out the arguments being made on both sides. So it's very riddled with bias, despite the fact that it is an enormously expensive system to operate, far more expensive than life without parole, the next harshest punishment in most states' laws.
Laura Moy is with Amnesty International, and we've long admired your organization's work on this issue. And in conclusion, I'd like for you to speak about what you and your peers are doing on this issue and how we might follow or take part in that?
Well, we hope that you'll go to our website, amnestyusa.org, amnestyusa.org, and you can find out what we're working on. We are very excited to see that California's voters have signed petitions to put the issue of the death penalty on their ballot, and there are ways that folks can support that. But they have an opportunity this November to replace the death penalty with life without parole, and it will save the state enormous amounts of money and redirect some of the savings towards helping to solve open homicide and rape cases. So there are some ways that folks even outside of California can help with that struggle, and we hope that you'll go to our website. You can find a piece on this on our blog and get tuned in and join with us in this overall fight to end this inhuman and outmoded practice. We can do better as a country that says it believes in human rights.
Well said, Laura Moy of Amnesty International, AIUSA.org. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you so much.
This is 5 O'Clock Shadow. I'm Robert Knight in New York. Coming up, we'll be speaking about a secret deal for the United States to stay well into the third decade of this century in the nation of Afghanistan. Coming up right after this.
I declare. Nu är troligt vi kan leva av plast och syntetisk mat. Om någon stjäler fra de unga som blir sent ut för att slåss. Nu är stjäler fra de många som kommer till oss. En himmel full av stjärnor, blått hav så långt du ser. En jord där blomster gror, kan du önska mer. Sammen ska vi leva, var syster och var bror.
One blue sky above us, one ocean lapping all our shore, one earth so green and round, who could ask for more? And because I love you, I'll give it one more try. To show my rainbow race, it's too soon to die. Some folks want to be like an ostrich, bury their heads in the sand. Some hope that plastic dreams can unclench all those greedy hands. Some hope to take the easy way. Poisons, bombs, they think we need them. Don't you know you can't kill all the unbelievers? There's no shortcut to freedom.
One blue sky above us, one ocean lapping all our shores. So green.
Children, tell all the mothers and fathers too. Now it's our last chance to learn to share what's been given to me and you.
One blue sky above us, one ocean lapping all our shores, one earth so green and round. Ask for more, and because I love you, I'll give it one more try to show my rainbow rays. It's too soon to die.
One blue sky above us,
one blue sky above us. One ocean lapping all our shores, one earth so green and brown, who could ask for more?
The sound of a recent rally in Norway where the death penalty is also a matter of some discussion. A rally called performing the song by Pete Seeger in the wake of an event, a murderous event by some fool whose name is unimportant. And there the issue of the death penalty has been foregone for other means of crime and punishment. This is 5 o'clock Shadow. I'm Robert Knight in New York. And we now turn our eyes once again to the nation of Afghanistan, and we're joined live by Robert Naiman of Just Foreign Policy. And Robert, the reason we wanted to talk to you today is because I'm hearing there's a secret deal to keep U.S. troops in Afghanistan until 2025. Welcome back to the show, and what do you know about that?
Well, as far as I know, there is not actually a secret deal to keep U.S. troops in Afghanistan until 2025. What was reported recently is that the United States and Afghanistan have penciled an agreement for long-term cooperation. We haven't seen the text of that agreement. It hasn't been approved, formally approved in either country. It has to be supposed to be approved by the Afghan parliament. Unfortunately, like similar agreements with Iraq, there's no procedure for it to have it be approved by the U.S. Congress. But according to press reports, it doesn't actually say anything about an agreement on future troop levels in Afghanistan, future U.S. troop levels in Afghanistan after 2014. That supposedly, according to press reports, is going to be covered by a subsequent status of forces agreement. We do know, according to press reports, that if the Pentagon has its way, U.S. troops are going to be in Afghanistan for a long time after 2014. They have indicated, this has indicated plans to draw down troops in Afghanistan.
The thing that may trouble some about the ongoing establishment of the military relationship between the United States and occupied Afghanistan is that we've seen tricks done before in other countries. We've seen the continuation of U.S. troops in Iraq simply through the subterfuge of saying they're not combat troops. So when you speak of the training and other services to be rendered by the American soldiers and not to mention the privatized personnel there, aren't we talking about a rose smelling pretty much the same?
Well, I'll make the following prediction. If they are allowed to, the Pentagon will keep U.S. troops in Afghanistan forever. We saw in the case of Iraq that the Pentagon was dragged kicking and screaming to signing an agreement with the Iraqi government that said all U.S. troops have to be 31st, 2011. And they only agreed to that in the hope that later they could have.
Robert, your signal seems to be intermittent. Are you able to hear me?
Yes, I can hear you.
Okay. Keep speaking, move around a little bit, and we'll try and find a stable point.
Okay, let me try moving in this direction.
Yeah, that's it. Keep speaking as you move.
Okay.
That sounds good right there, yes.
Okay, so we saw in the case of Iraq that the Pentagon was bad-kicking and screaming to signing an agreement, and then they tried every means to resist complying with the agreement. Eventually, it failed, and the U.S. did pull all of its uniformed troops out of Iraq by December. That doesn't mean that there aren't people employed by the U.S. Government still in Iraq. But what they can do with the uniformed U.S. soldiers, what even the CIA or special forces can do in Iraq is extremely limited, because it is the U.S. troops are the sea in which they want to move. That's why they want to keep uniform. That's part of why they want to keep uniform U.S. troops. In other words, they want the bases. You know, the people have to be somewhere. And so it is possible to restrict their activity, close to zero. And this is what we have in Iraq today. And if we could get to the place in Afghanistan or in Iraq, that would be a tremendous victory for humanity and a tremendous defeat for the Pentagon. What they want is to keep at least thousands of U.S. troops in Afghanistan, and to have that the basis of continuing to have special forces there at CIA there, carrying out drone strikes into Pakistan.
Is Afghanistan strategically useful for future interventions? Is it strategically useful even beyond the tremendous amount of opium and poppies and heroin that comes from there?
Well, I think there's no question that the Pentagon sees Afghanistan as a base of operations in the region, and particularly a base of operations into Pakistan. They are using it that way now. And many people in the national security establishment see, they don't even care about Afghanistan that much. They see Pakistan as the real prize, and they see Afghanistan as a platform for which to carry out strikes in Pakistan. And if the U.S. military were forced to leave Afghanistan, then they would lose that base of operations. That would strongly curtail their ability to carry out military operations in Pakistan, which, of course, also under pressure from Pakistanis. They're previously carrying out drone strikes in Pakistan from bases in Pakistan, so they're even more dependent now on bases in Afghanistan to carry out drone strikes into Pakistan.
This is 5 O'Clock Shadow, and we're speaking with Robert Nayman of Just Foreign Policy. And one other major question we have for you today, Robert, is about the question of U.S. military intervention or support for the externally funded rebels in the nation of Syria. Overnight, we hear about a ship that stopped over in Turkey and in Egypt and was stopped by Lebanese authorities, from which that ship was removed, three containers of weapons clearly marked as having come from those racist rebels in Libya that were supported by the United States and NATO in overthrowing the Libyan Arab Jamahiriya. There are statements coming from the Obama administration, from members of Congress, from the State Department, that the United States is going to, quote, support, quote, the rebels or attempt to overthrow the government in Syria. What is your latest understanding of all of these not-so-secret operations?
Well, first of all, the U.S. has clearly indicated its willingness and plans to provide so-called non-lethal aid to the rebels, which is kind of an oxymoron, because if you give tools to armed people who are going to use those tools to carry out armed attacks, and then we played. And we saw the same game in the 1980s when the Reagan administration gave so-called humanitarian aid to the Contras. But in addition to that, we also know that the U.S. is clearly aware that there are others, Qatar, the Saudis, the Libyans that are willing to supply arms to the Syrian rebels, and the U.S. isn't doing anything to stop that. And that is very unfortunate because, you know, the U.S. wanted to impose an arms embargo on Syria, which might have been a good idea if it had been real arms embargo. In other words, not just an arms embargo on the Syrian government, but an arms embargo on, mm-hmm. on the Syrian government and the armed rebels. But the Russians said, you know, we saw how that worked in Libya. You know, we agreed to an arms embargo on the Libyan, on Libya, and then you went and armed the rebels. So we're not going to play that game. Mm-hmm. So the fact that the U.S. wasn't willing to talk about a real arms embargo, an arms embargo on all sides, I think undermines the ability of diplomats to try and restrict the flow of weapons coming into the country. And we saw, you know, Kofi Annan, who's the former Secretary General and is now the UN Arab League envoy, has been very clear saying that further militarization of the conflict is not going, is going to undermine diplomatic efforts towards the resolution. So I think the U.S. Support of the rebels and, you know, winking at the arming of the rebels by other countries to which it's allied is a very negative phenomenon that's undermining international diplomatic efforts to resolve the crisis.
Well, I thank you for the analysis today, Robert, and people who need to know about real international study might do well to visit you at the website justforeignpolicy.org. Why don't you tell us what you're up to and what people might find?
Well, the last week we did an alert in response to the reports that the CIA has requested authority to expand its drone strikes in Yemen, particularly the so-called signature strikes, where they, contrary to the claims of administration officials, where they say that these drone strikes only target, you know, named people, suspected al-Qaeda terrorists on the list. In fact, in Pakistan and now apparently in Yemen, the CIA wants to strike people based on intelligence of suspicious activity. This is clearly, we think, a political vulnerability for the administration because, of course, these sorts of strikes increase the risk of civilian casualties and they increase the risk of killing people that have no, you know, they have guns, but they have no dispute with the United States. So we think this is an area of weakness. So we did an alert on this last week, and we wrote about it. We also participated in the drone summit this past weekend with Code Pink and Reprieve and the Center of Constitutional Rights. And this is something that, you know, people around the country are talking about, what are we going to do about these drone strikes? So I think that in the coming weeks and months, we're going to see some initiatives in Congress to try and limit these drone strikes in various ways, and that's something that we're working on developing.
Well, thank you so much once again, Robert Naiman of justforeignpolicy.org. Always an education. Thank you.
Good to see you.
This is 5 O'Clock Shadow. I'm Robert Knight in New York. I'd like to give thanks for production of today's program to Thiago Barroso and engineering to Michael G. Haskins. And we also welcome your leaks and suggestions and tips and leads with an email to theshadow@wbai.org. And for 5 O'Clock Shadow, I'm Robert Knight in New York. And we conclude with this by the Red Paintings.
Two objects and their fields, a ragged cup and a twisted map, the face of Jesus in my soup, those sinister dinner deals, the meal trolley's wicked wheels and a hooked bone rising from my food, all things good or ungood. And the mercy seat is waiting, and I think my head is burning, and in a way I'm yearned to be done with all this weighing up of truth. An eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, and I've got nothing left to lose, and I'm not afraid to die. interpret signs and catalog. A blackened tooth, a scarlet fog. The walls are a bad black bottom kind. They are the sick breath at my hind. They are the sick breath at my hind. They are the sick breath at my hind. They are the sick breath gathering at my hind. I hear stories from the chamber, how Christ was born into a manger, and like some ragged stranger died upon the cross. And might I say it seemed so fitting, in its way he was a carpenter by trade. Or at least that's what I'm told. Like my good hand, I tattooed evil across its brother's fist. That filthy five did nothing to challenge or resist. In heaven his throne is made of gold, and his ark of his testament bestowed. A throne from which I'm told all history does unfold. Down here it's made of wooden wire, and its body is on fire. And God is never far away. Into the mercy seat I climb. My head, my head is wide, and like a moth that tries to enter the bride, I go shuffling out of life, just to hide in death a while. And anyway, I never lie. I told a lie.